Chapter 61. The air in Admiral Joseph Kemper's Pentagon office reeked of stale cigarette smoke and half-eaten sandwiches, and it almost seemed to crackle under the invisible cloud of tension. Kemper and Jean Seagram were huddled over the Admiral's desk in quiet conversation, while Mel Donner and Warren Nicholson, the CIA director, sat together on the sofa, their feet propped on a coffee table, and dozed. But they jerked upright in full wakefulness when the strange buzz that was specially tuned into Kemper's red telephone broke the hushed quiet. Kemper grunted into the receiver and laid it back in its cradle. "It was the security desk. The president is on his way up." Donner and Nicholson glanced at each other and heaved themselves off the sofa. They had no sooner cleared the coffee table of the evening's debris, straightened their ties and donned their coats, when the door opened and the president strode in, followed by his Kremlin security advisor, Marshal Collins. Kemper came from behind his desk and shook the president's hand.
"Nice to see you, Mr. President. Please make yourself at home. May I get you something?"
The president scanned his watch and then grinned. 3 hours yet before the bars close. How about a Bloody Mary?" Kemper grinned back and nodded to his aide.
"Commander Keith, will you do the honors?"
Keith nodded. "One Bloody Mary coming up, sir."
"I hope you gentlemen won't mind me standing watch with you," the president said, "but I have a heavy stake in this, too."
"Not at all, sir," Nicholson answered. "We're happy to have you." "What is the situation at the moment?"
Admiral Kemper gave a full briefing to the president, describing the unexpected ferocity of the hurricane, showing the positions of the ships on a projected wall map, and explaining the Titanic's towing operation.
"Was it absolutely necessary that the Juno be ordered off station?" the president asked.
"A distress call is a distress call," Kemper replied solemnly, "and must be answered by every ship in the area, regardless of the circumstances."
"We have to play according to the other team's rules until halftime," Nicholson said. "After that, it's our game."
"Do you think, Admiral Kemper, that the Titanic can stand up to the battering of a hurricane?"
"As long as the tugs can keep her bow into the wind and sea, she's an odds-on favorite to come through with flying colors."
"And if for some reason the tugs cannot keep her from swinging broadside to the waves?" Kemper avoided the president's gaze and shrugged.
"Then it's in God's hands."
"Nothing could be done."
"No, sir.
There is simply no way to protect any one vessel caught in the clutches of a hurricane. It becomes a case of every ship for herself."
"I see." A knock at the door, and another officer entered, laid two slips of paper on Kemper's desk, and retreated. Kemper read the notes and looked up, his face set in a grim expression.
"A message from the Capricorn," he said. "Your wife, Mr. Seagram. Your wife is reported missing. A search party aboard the ship was unable to locate her. They fear she was lost overboard. I'm sorry."
Seagram sagged into Collins' arms, his eyes widened in stunned horror.
"Oh, my God," he cried. "It can't be true. Oh, God, what am I going to do? Dana. Dana."
Donner rushed to his side. "Steady, Jean, steady." He and Collins steered Seagram over to the sofa and gently lowered him to the cushions. Kemper gestured to the president for his attention.
"There's another message, sir, from the Samuel R. Wallace, one of the tugs towing the Titanic."
"The towing cable," Kemper said. "It snapped. The Titanic is adrift in the center of the hurricane."
The cable hung like a dead snake over the stern of the Wallace, its severed end swaying in the black depths a quarter of a mile below. Butera stood frozen beside the great electric winch, refusing to believe his eyes.
"How?" he shouted in Ensign Kelly's ear. "How could it part? It was built to take worse stress than this."
"Can't figure it," Kelly yelled back above the storm. "There was no extreme stress on her when she went."
"Bring her up, Ensign,"
Let's take a look.
The ensign nodded and gave the orders. The brake was released, and the wheel began turning, pulling the wire up from the sea. A solid sheet of spray dashed against the cable house. The dead weight of the wire acted as an anchor, dragging down the stern of the Wallace. And each time a column of water approached, it rose high over the wheelhouse and came thundering down upon it with a shock that jarred the entire tug. At last, the end of the tow cable appeared over the stern and snaked up onto the reel. As soon as the brake was applied, Butera and Kelly moved in and began examining the frayed strands. Butera stared at it, his face twisted in stunned incomprehension. He touched the burned wire ends and looked dumbly at the ensign. The ensign did not share Butera's muteness.
"Jesus Christ in heaven," he shouted hoarsely. "It's been cut through with an acetylene torch."
Pitt was down on his hands and knees on the cargo floor of the helicopter, sweeping his flashlight under the folded passenger seats when the Titanic's tow cable dropped into the sea. Outside, the wind howled with demonic power. Pitt couldn't have known it, but without the tug's steadying influence, the Titanic's bows were being forced by the raging sea to leeward, exposing her entire flank to the unleashed furies. She was beginning to broach to. It had taken him only 2 minutes to find Dana's makeup kit, where it had solidly jammed behind one of the folded front seats, immediately behind the control cabin bulkhead. He could easily see why she had had difficulty retrieving the blue nylon case from its prison. Very few women are blessed with mechanical inclinations, and Dana was definitely not one of them. It hadn't occurred to her to simply unclasp the restraining straps and unfold the seat. Pitt did so, and the kit fell free in his hand. He didn't bother opening it. He wasn't interested. What he was interested in was the recessed compartment in the forward bulkhead, where a 20-man life raft sat, or where it was supposed to sit. The yellow, rubberized cover was there all right, but the raft was gone. Pitt had no time to appreciate the implication of his discovery. Even as he pulled the empty cover out of its compartment, a monstrous sea crashed against the flank of the helpless Titanic, heeling her great mass over on her starboard side as though she never meant to stop. Pitt made a desperate grab for one of the seat supports, but his fingers closed on air, and he was spilled like a sack of potatoes down across the sloping floor, crashing against the partially open cargo door with such force that he ripped a 4-inch gash in his scalp. Mercifully, the next few hours were lost to Pitt. He was aware of a cold gale sweeping into the fuselage, but not much else. His mind was a vague mass of gray wool, and he felt remotely detached from his surroundings. He could not know, or even sense, when the helicopter shed its triple-lashed moorings and was hurled sideways, dropping off the first-class lounge roof onto the boat deck, crumpling its tail section, tearing off its rotor blades, before grinding over the railing and falling toward the tormented sea.